Thanks for setting this up. All right, Hogcast. It'll be my second one. I'm going to continue the tradition and great idea that General Nestor brought in. I'm not going to do it as often as him. We're going to do it once a month. Today, we'll obviously start off with Babble Time, and then we're going to talk about our exercise that we supported, CAST 3.0, down in Florida this past month. We'll get to those details later, but let's talk about Babble Time first. So $25 more on the table, so the booty's up to $50 to see if you can figure out what Babble Time means. I had some guesses. Bob, you actually had a pretty well thought out guess. Kind of blew my mind in regards to your thought process and how deep you are. So he thought, hey, Rio is my call sign, and Rio is Spanish for river. So, you know, Babbling Brook River. So well thought out. I also had a lady, a Master Sergeant Gardner out at Moody. She's probably listening to this podcast from Estonia, no kidding. And she thought maybe I had a speech impediment that I overcame. And, you know, I said, oh, I appreciate that thought, but that was not me. Anyway, so right now, Babble Time, why do we call it Babble Time, is up to $50. So
the real question is, you know, not everybody feels as comfortable as me just dropping an email to the wing commander. What's the best avenue for people to guess?
Bob Jennings. So send it to our PA.
Thanks.
If you don't want to send it to me. But, you know, since as the money continues to climb, people will hopefully get more bold and be able to bounce it off me. Maybe in the future I'll give hints of this, but it's within my Air Force career. So I'll give you that hint. All right. Well, let's first talk about this UTA, a real good UTA. I was able to go down to Moody Air Force Base and see the 476 fighter group. Fairly impressed. I've been down there before, but their operation is great. The people are great. I was kind of blown away with how many people actually drive, you know, upwards of 5, 6, 7, 8 hours to get to that unit. And I asked them why, and it's basically the unit. So good operation being run down there currently by Colonel Waring, but quite honestly, the senior NCOs, the chiefs, the squadron commanders, just the whole leadership team is why people head down there. And I think Sapper, you know, kind of the uniqueness of Moody Air Force Base. It's kind of isolated. You know, Valdosta is certainly not a metropolitan shining gem, but people really like it there. And, you know, for example, the pilots are all living in Valdosta, you know, where they don't have to. You know, typically some of them are airline pilots. They could live somewhere else. But something's good about that community, and if you can confirm that or deny that, Sapper.
Absolutely. I spent 3 years at Moody in the 75th Fighter Squadron. When I left here, went straight there on active duty, and we live in a little town called Hayhira, which is just northwest of Valdosta, and it was old south town, very tame, had everything you needed, nothing more. And yeah, overall it was a great 3-year experience living 18 miles north of the Florida line, and I would have gone back there in a heartbeat. Ops tempo was incredibly yep. high, and just having that associate unit, which is opposite of what we have here, where the reservists are the majority of your senior IPs in the squadrons. And then helping out the 74th and 5th is a pretty neat time to be down there.
Yeah, I would say that wing and that fighter group has probably been the workhorse of the Air Force over the last 20 years, being that they have 2 squadrons of A-10s and what we did in Afghanistan over mm-hmm. the last 2 decades. They've got a huge history, obviously, going way back, but I think what they did over the last, you know, 20 years is amazing. That TFI relationship is the best it's ever been, thanks to the leadership building it up. And I remember when we first stood up that fighter group, and the officer in charge was mowing his own grass with his own lawnmower, and now we're fully integrated, and you know, like some of the lead IPs. Dirt, he won the GO of the year, and it's because of his action during the deployment where they got surprised 10 days out the door, and he was actually acting as their weapons officer and lead IP downrange. So that's the relationship that has budded up with that wing. With that fighter group and the other fighter group. So good point out. They had a change of command down there. So Lieutenant Colonel Boom Bone gave command to Kalis Quimi. So that was good to see. Obviously walked around a lot. And I'll tell you what, I went to the range, which is, you know, a 10-minute drive and a pretty neat range, so close. And it was the first time I've really been into a range where I was that close to the A-10, and it was a good experience for me. You know, 20 plus years, many years flying the airplane. It was a good impression there. I also saw the biggest snake I've ever seen in my life outside of a zoo. When we're coming back from the range, there was this water moccasin on the road. They're just sitting on the road, and it was just sitting there, and I couldn't believe it. I still have my feet up, and I'm glad I was in a pickup truck, cheap Bowens Silverado, because that thing was huge. And of note, it was only like 200 meters away from the Child Development Center. So I thought that was strange, but I think they have alligators down there too. But great trip down there, and I was able to see some of their traditions and watch that change of command for the 76th Fighter Squadron road trip. Some other things that happened on the UTA, we had an assumption of command up here. Major Calamanco took over the MXS officially, so that was awesome. We had a chief promotion where Jessica Cable is now Chief Master Sergeant Cable in the Security Forces. That's huge. Nick McRoberts retired. It was significant, and we saw some, we'll call him older McRoberts. Aaron McRoberts came out here. I wish I got to see him. He's kind of an old school crew chief that used to do a lot of good for our unit. We had the leadership development course. Mike Addis, props to him. He set that up, and he had probably about 20 individuals, both of the young officers and senior NCOs, that kind of went through some of the leadership stuff that I wish, and Sapper, probably you wish you were exposed to rather than figure it out yourself. You know, money, you know, just kind of the stuff they don't teach you as your primary AFSC. We competed for the Hennessy Award, which was it's basically a services spec kitchen competition. Four units in AFRIC were nominated. We were one of the four, so we ran that competition. We actually ran it at the deployment center because it was so windy that day. And Bob, I think you were able to eat. So.
I was, yeah, it was pretty good.
Yeah, it was surprisingly good, and hopefully we did well. I made sure to coin the judge, and I talked about, you know, she basically is a civilian that is taking time away from her restaurant, which is in San Francisco, right down to the wharf, and, you know, she's volunteering to judge our food services, and made sure I coined her. And I've been to where she has a restaurant, $20,000 a month in rent for her small shop. That was kind of crazy, but that's San Francisco and California for you. So appreciate the Midwest. Let's see here. Another good thing is we had a load team compete at the AFRIC load competition down at Carswell, and we won. So that's an awesome thing. We competed with four teams, and again, we won out of the four teams. So we'll now go on to AFCO Comp. It's a large-scale munitions generation competition at Beale, where each MAGCOM is represented. And believe it or not, this will be our third time in a row where we're at representing AFRIC and that competition. So that's awesome. They did ACE bomb builds, mass generation, an alternate bomb build on dunnage and pallets, an ammo relay, a tractor trailer event, and then I think they did a true event, and we won. So that's awesome. Senior Master Sergeant David Hamilton was the lead. The team members were Master Sergeant Joshua Barnett and Tech Sergeant Matthew Hoffman, Tech Sergeant Adam Brockhouse, Staff Sergeant Devin Ellis, and Senior Airman Jack Hedrick. So they went down and crushed it a third time in a row. Doesn't surprise me. If you see the load team's work, it blows my mind. So ammo flight, doing great things as usual. So that's pretty much what our UTA had. Obviously, the load competition occurred before, and the Hennessy and leadership development course occurred afterwards. So a lot of people putting in more than just the standard 2 days, coming out here to get better and, you know, develop as an airman or to help the unit out. So that's awesome stuff. That's the roundup of the UTA. Now we're going to go and talk about our deployment down to Florida. You know, my observation, I've been in this unit a long time, and this was not just normal TDY. We do high-end stuff during the week, every week, and then, you know, we do a couple times a year, we do a high-end TDY, and this one was special. I think it was just more diverse, more dynamic, more of a challenge, and I just wanted to talk about it, and just good things from both sides of ops and maintenance in regards to how we performed down there. Went down there lean. I know you guys were right on the line when it came to pilots, so you guys were working hard, and I assume you guys didn't go down there with a surplus of bodies.
Absolutely not.
Okay, so we'll start with who do we have representing and talking about this. We've got Lieutenant Colonel Tice. He's the DO of the Fighter Squadron. We got Major Ponch Bevis. He was the projo for the wing that helped design and set this up. And then we have Sergeant Hankins, who's the pro super down there. So that's who's going to talk about this. I'm going to lead off with Ponch.
Yeah, CAS 3.0, this is the second time. We went there last year as well, and we supported fully just that. So this year we're trying to plus it up a little bit and do other stuff other than just CAS, our primary mission. We also did combat search and rescue.
Okay.
Another one of our primary missions, and then we also threw in some dissimilar air combat training with F-15s and F-16s planned, as well as introduction to FARP with MC-130s and ICT operations with dislocated maintenance up at Moody and with live drop as well.
Gotcha. So we basically had operations at three locations at MacDill?
Yes, MacDill, and then we had 11 maintainers up at and bomb builders up at Moody.
Okay. And I think we partnered with the Moody ICT teams. They by the way, were happy to see how our jets looked compared to the 23rd Fighter Group in the 23rd Wing. They were impressed all the way around. They were also impressed with our ICT team. I think we sent our A team up there.
Yeah, Sergeant Russell Roberts, he was the main POC that I talked to on setting up the ICTs for that. And from his report that he sent, it averaged 25 minutes to get a two-ship through with loading two bombs and refueling the last day. Since the one weather cancel we had because of the weather up at Moody, we weren't able to load the bombs, but we transferred that to the next day and they loaded four bombs per jet, and they still averaged 25 minutes to get four bombs hung on jets and a few thousand pounds of gas.
Yeah, if you think about that, loading four bombs, taking gas in less than 30 minutes, that's a huge advantage we'd have as an airframe over other airframes.
And on average, when we're doing hot pits here, we're on the ground for 40 minutes.
Yeah. I think some of the pilots said that their bombs were loaded before they got their gas.
Yes.
And that's telling to our load teams and such. Also, when they're up there, I think they got qualified on some new weapons as well. Can you talk to that?
Actually, I can't. I'm not 100% sure on that. So
okay.
I think
yes, sir. They did some emerging weapons that are coming out for the A-10 community. As you can imagine, the TOs out there, and we don't have all the trainers and things here. So we were able to send our quote-unquote A-team, if you will, our instructors, to go get called on a couple weapons that we're going to use potentially on this next trip overseas. And they were able to get fully qualified so that they can come be the instructors back here for us on those weapons.
And those weapons are the MALD
and
the small diameter SCBs. So we don't have, I don't think we have the rack for the SCBs here or?
Unknown. I think actually we potentially have the bruise here for the SDBs, but we don't have any trainer SDBs on property is my understanding.
So awesome job maintenance, taking advantage of some white space and getting qualified in something that we want to be qualified as soon as possible. So that was good. So that was the ICTs up at Moody. And again, I think we partnered with the 476 and they were really happy with the team and just real good operation. Pulled lives out of there. They do ICTs all the time. That's the first time they loaded lives. So when we dropped them at a range in Florida, correct?
Yeah, Pine Castle Range. It's actually Navy controlled. Okay. But for the most part, it's you just show up and we just did BSA, basic surface attack.
Okay, awesome. So that's the ICTs up at Moody. We also did some events at Avon Park, which is an auxiliary training field aligned with MacDill, correct?
Yes, that's actually MacDill Oxfield.
Okay.
It just falls in the Avon Park complex. That's where a lot of the other assets that we dealt with. We worked with 14 other units for CAS 3.0 and then three additional units outside of the CAS 3.0 TDY.
Okay.
So yeah, at MacDill Ox, we did FARP, forward air refueling point, and so that was with MC-130 just right there on there. They had already an old taxiway or runway that was surveyed for FARP locations. I think we sent four jets through the FARP, and we also did some austere landing cert at night with the IR markers. I think we did at least two upgrades, maybe three upgrades on that.
Okay.
Alone.
And that airfield, I think, is better than it used to be. I remember we planned a TDY down there, and it was like, oh my God, it's a disaster. But they've done some upgrades to it, exception the lights.
Yes.
I think it's still a day-only field.
Correct.
So we did some, it's called Box-in-One, which are basically just four IR lights.
Yes.
To kind of give you perception. And then they have, a end of runway lights as well.
Yeah, so the way they actually CCT set up, they did two dual boxes so we could take off or land either direction based off winds. So they had 2,000-foot IR boxes set up on the edge of the runways to basically mark the landing zone.
Gotcha.
On either end. It's an 8,000-foot runway, 150 feet wide. It's a good piece of concrete.
Yeah, good pavement, but not good lighting. So qualified three guys for night austere landings, and then I know there's a restriction. You can't qualify any pilot, you have to be an IP or a four-ship? I can't remember the...
We're still talking about that.
Okay. I want to say in the book, sir, it's a two-ship flight lead requirement to be certified. But as things, you can do some one-time events with young guys and instructors.
Yep.
And you're just not certified to go out and do it yourself.
Track. I remember Action. When I was a squadron commander, I got him to do the austere dry lake bed. That guy has 4,000 hours and was dry. He landed on dirt roads before, you know.
Same with me.
Yeah, same with Ponch. So, I mean, you got to use some commander judgment there. So, awesome. That's great stuff at Avon Park. Where'd the MC-130s come from?
I can't remember.
Were they from Patrick?
I believe they're from Hulbert.
Hulbert, okay.
Yeah.
So that's an active duty unit supporting us?
Yes. Okay. There's a lot of active duty. There's some guard units and all, as well as reserve units.
What an awesome TFI mix, which just shows the capability of the full force. That's great. All right, so that's Avon Park. Did we send any maintenance out to Avon Park?
No, we did not.
Just the FARP teams, and it was just fueling only.
No, yeah, it was actually just the MC-130 crews that did all the FARPing.
Awesome. They're fully qualified, and, you know, they're awesome at it. How far away did we refuel?
Well, it seems like 150 or 300.
Okay. Yeah, so there's regs in the book, and it's a 300-foot hose, I believe. And so I want to say it's like no closer than 150 feet, and then there's some other regs. But I was able to be the first guy to go through the FARP location at Avon Park. And, yeah, it was a lot, I don't know what the word is, lamer than I thought it would be. Yep. Like, I thought it would be super crazy and exciting, and they're so good at it. That FARP team was so good at it, they made it basically a non-event. You pull up at a gas station, and they do all the work for you. It's like a gas station back in the 1950s. So it was great. Super easy. And so once we were able to see that, it was a full send, as you say.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. You know, when it comes to us refueling as pilots, it's kind of just taxiing to the right location, and then they do all the work. You know, it's not that extreme of an event from the pilot perspective. Right. Obviously, you can cause damage to the airplane if you're not doing the refueling properly. And I know that there's been some instances where people have FARPed and hurt an airplane because they overpressurize and stuff like that. So I think the on-the-ground stuff is a little more challenging than the pilot stuff. So it's good observation there. Okay, that's Avon Park. Anything else out at Avon Park?
Not on the field itself, no.
Okay. And then we were at MacDill, and that's where most of our operations went down. We worked out of the duct. And we had, what, 6 airplanes and then grow to 10?
We had 6 airplanes for the first week where we did a 4-turn-4 day to night. And actually, it was the Friday we plused up because that was our weather backup for the night. We actually added 2 lines for that to get additional training that was required for some of the guys we were working with. And then the second week, we plused up to 10 jets.
Gotcha.
We did an 8-turn-6 day night.
I think of note, the first 2 weeks was paid for by outside sources, and
correct,
then we sourced our stuff. So a great use of resources capturing resources to make us better. We do that with our JTAC program every week. So from the maintenance perspective, how is MacDill? How do they treat us there?
Oh, MacDill is great. Of course, you being in Tampa in the middle of February, you definitely have not much to complain about there. As far as the maintenance request from ops, it was a tall task. And I have to give our guys credit. They grinded. There was only 10 aircraft. Some days we were flying 8-turn-8s. So it was a pretty exciting trip. You have to tip your cap to the guys. I think I was looking at the numbers before I came over here. Looks like we flew almost 400 hours, 164 sorties, 97% MC rate, lacking parts, had to find creative ways of getting parts. But basically going into a 8-turn-6, you need 10 jets every day. And we only brought 10. So the night shift crew working late into the night to turn those aircraft to make sure we had 10 for the next day. It was really phenomenal, especially looking and seeing what the request was.
Yep.
We were thinking, can we do that? But of course, our guys found a way to do it, and it was just really exciting to be there.
Yeah, that last comment, we found a way to do it. Our unit does that all the time. How many lines do we miss down there?
We didn't miss any lines.
Yeah, 0. That's the standard.
We actually added 3 lines.
Added
so
3
we
lines.
Are 103% FMC.
And, that we kind of think that is standard. It's not standard. You know, there's units that are not making combat lines. And we've never had that situation. A training environment, undermanned or min-manned, parts not all being there, making it happen, and not missing a single line. So, again, props to our maintenance team for doing it again. I'll never take it for granted. So, are you the pro super? Were you the day pro super or the night pro super?
I was the day pro super.
Okay.
Senior Fromm was the night pro super.
Okay. Talk to me about some of the creative way you got parts and stuff like that. Because airplanes were breaking, and then the next morning they'd be fixed. That's kind of my perception.
We actually had some parts flown in for Chiefs. Colonel McLeod flew some parts in for us when he was coming up to visit. So they just packed them in their luggage and brought them up, and we found a way. Of course, getting parts nowadays, you know, it's seems like it's impossible. Every time something breaks, we're always looking at the supply system. We're like, oh, are we going to have that? So we would probably, I think we ended up having to pull some parts off the jets here just to bring them up there. But like I said, always seemed to make it work.
Yeah, you know, traditionally maintenance goes with we'll call it a low to a medium risk package. You know, you bring a lot of stuff, you bring a lot of people. I think that's not what you did this time. And that causes problems when you do have issues. And I think you guys just, you know, is that ACE? I think that's ACE. That's solving problems when they arise rather than having the problem solved based on your stock and stuff like that. So impressive job adding lines rather than losing lines. So that's great. And, you know, the observation from Colonel Leiter when he went down there was maintenance is crushing it. When Colonel McConnell came back, you know, the Deputy Ops Group Commander, he said the same thing. So, you know, those are pilots giving props to maintenance at the highest level I've seen. So that's great job down there. Tell me about one of the biggest things. Give me a story about how someone went above and beyond and got something fixed or did something, you know, exceptional.
I mean, that probably happened every day. Shout out to electricians. Had an issue with the generator on 631. Didn't know exactly what was wrong with it, so we ended up swapping the generator, the GCU, from one side to the other because they couldn't duplicate it, doing that type of maintenance, and it was able to help us troubleshoot it when we had an issue because the problem followed on to the opposite side, you know, the very next sortie when we ended up C&D-ing it because we couldn't find it. So doing things like that was pretty good. Too bad we don't have Fromm on here and all the stories he has for things that they accomplished at nighttime, because we would roll leaving from days having 7-8 aircraft, and somehow they were able to turn 2 more airplanes and give us 10 the next day. So kudos to them, especially the night shift crew. Those guys really killed it. And it was Nick McRoberts' last TDY.
Okay.
Shout out to him. What a legend.
Yep.
I've served with him for the last 20 years and hate to see that guy go, but you mentioned his retirement earlier. So
yeah, absolutely.
Some kudos.
Yeah, Nick launched me in combat many times, and I'll remember that one. He wouldn't let me go, and I said, "You got to pull the chock, Scott. I just got to go." That was kind of when we were both just getting to know each other, because he wanted to do a Mode 4 check on me. I said, "I don't need Mode 4 in Afghanistan." But yeah, Nick was a legend. I think that's a huge, huge word and proper description for him. So yeah, props to him down there. Well, good. So great time down there, and you know, obviously working hard. I saw the night shifts productivity. So absolutely. All right, well, let's go.
So
go ahead, Sapper.
If I can pile onto this, if you will. So as the DO of the fighter squadron, it's always interesting to learn how maintenance does things and how creative they get continually. And you said every day there was 100 different stories of how creative guys and gals are on the maintenance side to make the operation happen. And a couple of those events that I can throw on as well is Chef was our lead weapons guy down there, so loading weapons. While we did do a bunch of lives from Moody, we had that portion, but we also had a bunch of, call them live inerts. So they don't actually go bang, but they're 500-pound concrete bombs. And so we had, GBU-12s, laser-guided bombs?
And yeah, we had 20 of those and 8 38s.
So 38, GBU-38s being a GPS-guided weapon. And we loaded those throughout the TDY. And one day in particular, I was very fortunate enough to get my Sandy 1 qual down awesome. There. But on that day specifically, they had kind of leaned forward to try to drop the last 2 or 3 weapons for that night, and we ended up not being able to turn one of the airplanes that they planned, and looking over it and realizing that an airplane was fully loaded with heavyweights. And I remember looking at Chuff and going, can you do this? And are you guys able to do that? And it's former Marine.
Yeah.
Obviously, Roger that, sir. We got it in maybe 15, 20 minutes. I mean, it's fast.
Yeah, that one ready faster than we could refuel another aircraft, so it was really impressive.
Yeah, that day in particular, I shout out to all of maintenance for being creative, because that was probably our most challenging day, because we turned it into 8 turn 8, because that was our one day where we were doing night CSAR, so I had 4 lines for the CSAR and 4 lines for the CAS 3.0 support, and I think I talked to you on the phone a whole bunch that day, because I was soft all day, and just managing what lines and what, and what jets are getting the heavyweights, and moving jets around when they come up broken trying to get the CSR with min turn time. I think for the CSR, they had like an hour and 20, and we knew that was going to be a challenge, but the maintenance said they'd make it happen, and they did. So it was awesome.
You know, and that starts with a relationship. You know, a relationship, ops maintenance has always been really solid. But I think, you know, current leadership, Sapper, you've been mentioned many times, you absolutely have an ability to communicate what you need and understand what's going on and to come up with the solutions with them that gets us ready now and gets the exact set of airplanes that you need. So,
and you talk
for doing that.
You talk, sir, about, you know, taking it for granted. And I did have a conversation with as many maintainers as I could get in a room toward the end of my time there. I stayed for the first 2 weeks, and it was probably that Wednesday. I went over and gathered as many folks on the shift turnover that I could. And Halo and I went over there and told them what we were doing, at what level we could talk to them about that. And then I really wanted to highlight a point, and it was that the last two TDYs, so we went to Hill Air Force Base. The intent was to support a Marine Corps exercise, large force employment on two separate days. But we attempted to shoot Mavericks there as well, and forces outside of our control. We had 12 Mavericks loaded, but we couldn't do it. So all the guys are still giving me heck for that, but it's fine. But we had an event there where on one day it snowed, and when I mean snowed, it snowed like 6 to 9 inches, and four different times maintainers were on top of jets with push brooms sweeping off snow. And why was that significant is because the rest of the base canceled support for the Marines that had paid to be there and were trying to get training before a real world tasking, and nobody else showed up except for us.
Yep.
And we were the only assets that showed up all day long for these guys that were freezing on the side of a mountain in December in Utah. And then you go a month later, and we did it again.
We were that only launch.
We were the only launch all day, and we were the only unit that supported the folks that we went down there to support, and everybody else canceled for maintenance or weather or what. And we consistently, not only did we not cancel, but we provided 100% support to these guys that are counting on training assets to get better at their craft, essentially.
Yep.
So, and that goes a long way to point at maintenance and say that ops just makes an assumption that all the jets are ready all the time. And we shouldn't do that, because it is huge. It's a lot of ground to cover, especially as the jets are getting older. But it's fantastic to see that, you know, these young maintainers are setting an Air Force standard on how to support, you know, outside of our organization. So, very good thing.
Absolutely. Two incredible points that just make us different. You know, it's not about us all the time. It's, you know, it's about the guy on the ground. And that's the kind of a CAS mentality, an attack aircraft mentality, the mentality of our fighter wing. And, you know, we have relationships with those ground units because of that attitude and because of our performance all the time. So absolutely a good point out there. Why don't we talk about how many munitions we did drop? How many Mark 82s did we get out of Moody?
We got 24 Mark 82s.
Okay.
Total 28 inerts.
28 inerts. Were those 50s or slicks? Or
those are 50. They're 12s and 38s.
Okay. 12 and 38s. Yep. Okay. Awesome.
That was MacDill for the whole thing. 30 millimeter, we shot just under 18,000 rounds. And something else to emphasize on the CAS 3.0, everybody was shooting in the stack. So this is a huge live fire. You probably had at least 5+ assets in the stack. And everybody was shooting from top to bottom. And some were with heavyweights, some were with just TP 30 millimeter, and also the ground parties were shooting. They had 50 cal, they had mortars.
Ground burst simulators, they're practicing being under extreme stress and controlling air assets.
Yeah. Simultaneously. Someone's mentioned that this was the most busy stack that they've ever seen. Colonel Brown, the squadron commander, to include combat. That's impressive. And then they're all firing. In combat, you know, we don't always have everybody firing. It's usually, you know, who's lowest. But this is, you know, this is sounds like one of the, you know, J2 Thunders is the largest joint fires exercise probably in the world. This rivaled that, if not.
Close.
So incredible coordination to do that, because you're deconflicting with ground party, and you're also deconflicted with the fires in the air. And it sounds like fires from the ground as well. So phenomenal training just in the CAS 3.0 phase. Young pilots that you brought down there. So challenge with getting them right out in front right away. Not out in front, but right in the heat right away?
Yeah, we took our two newest A-10 pilots in the squadron down for basically the whole time, and they were not even complete with their mission qualification training here locally yet. So they did some of their upgrades down there, and that's a pretty big section of ground to cover for a young guy or gal to come in to go to this level of an exercise with that many assets, and the dynamic nature of what we were doing down there is pretty significant for them to hang on.
Did you guys do a special mission off Avon Park? Support, it was a hostage rescue again or something like that?
So there was a mission set where we went to another range straight north of Avon Park, and basically for the folks that were on the ground and doing controls, they wanted to, again, keep that stress going, so they moved them around. And so we did go up there and do some different mission sets to the north just so that the guys didn't quite know it was coming, just so they can practice adjustments to their plan real time.
Flexibility. So did you guys do pretty much two vols a day supporting CAST 3.0?
Depending on the day, for the most part, every go we had four jets supporting them. Some days we had six, and I think one or two days we had eight jets supporting. Okay. So, and these were 2.5-3 hour vol times. We had external tanks, and then I think there was one day just based off us downloading tanks for to do the dissimilar air combat training. We had a two-ship fly for almost 3 hours without a centerline bag and no air refueling.
And in each one of those days, even though we were doing two goes, if you will, two sets of jets taking off and landing, we were also doing multiple AOs, so multiple different sets of JTACs that were in different areas. So we would basically launch out, say, four aircraft, and two would go to one section, and two would go to another area, and then halfway through we would flop, or halfway through the other would join the other two, so we could combine effects with multiple A-10s to add more firepower to a specific scenario. So very fluid, very dynamic training.
Gotcha. Incredible. Well, let me just talk real quick about the other units that supported you. So do we have F-16s from Homestead?
There's one day of dissimilar air combat training we're going to do, but just based off of their other real-world taskings, they were not able to provide the training that we were wanting, so I ended
you
up...
You went with the guard
unit? I went with the F-15s out of Jacksonville. So we did all of our dissimilar training with them.
Okay. What about the Patrick Reserve Unit? Did they support?
Yes, they did. It was 301st Rescue Squadron. We worked with them. Their weapons officer and Halo got together and came up with great scenarios. We did three total CSARs on the second week with... I think every CSAR had some type of upgrade in it, whether a Sandy 3 or 4 or a Sandy 1 at night with the sapper. So and also I think Zoom did his check ride.
No notice. Who's the CFE on that one?
I was.
Okay, good job.
I also got shot down apparently in this scenario.
So obviously not taking the easy road, challenging yourself even when it was challenging already.
Yes. So, and all those scenarios were great. We only had the Helos, the HH-60s on Patrick working with us. I think next time it would be great if we can get the HC-130s integrated in that, and maybe some additional other parties or other airspace where we could go to.
And Sapper mentioned, I got a Sandy 1 upgrade. That's a huge qual, Sapper, so congratulations on that. And that's where you're basically going to be the lead in a combat search and rescue mission. And it's a very challenging role. And to get that qual, that is awesome. So congratulations on that. That's a huge, huge step. All right, so that's the CSAR. You kind of talked about that. DACT, that's dissimilar air combat training, and we don't do that a lot. So it was probably good to see it, and you didn't do it against a unit that was non-proficient. You went with an Eagle Squadron. That's pretty much their mainstay. Just think of them doing CAS with us. You know, just think of how we would just overwhelm them with knowledge based on that. So how did those DACT rides go?
From what I've heard from all the guys, they've got some great training in. We had at least, I believe three, maybe four flight leads that have never done DACT, so they got their flight lead upgrade on DACT completed as well, and the rest was continuation training or young guys that have never seen it before. So the F-15s were great training platforms. They would either replicate a MiG-29 or whatever else that we wanted to, or on the last day when I flew with them, I just said, hey, full up, let's see what we can do, and they can do some impressive stuff, and glad they're on our side.
Yeah. I remember in Korea, we had an F-15 squadron come in, and, you know, the toast was to the airframes. that are experts in one mission. You know, we're CAS, air to ground, and they're, you know, air to air, and it makes a big difference. Those guys are pros. And, you know, that community is no joke when it comes to being a pro with that. And I'm sure that unit's probably pretty similar to ours when it comes to, you know, qualifications and stuff like that. So that's awesome. All right. Are we missing anything? Take browse your after action report and see if there's any. Again, how many units did we work with?
17 units total, so 18 with us.
Incredible. So, yeah, so just any given month, any given TDY, we did DACT, CSAR, some of the most complex joint fire integrations with multiple units. We FARPed, we ICT'd, and we missed not a single line and actually added three. Live weapons, multiple inert drops, 17,000 rounds of 30 mic. Just another month for the 442nd. You know, that's what I want people to realize is this is not normal. This is nowhere near normal. This is very unique to our wing. So props. Funny thing, Ponch, I coined you before the TDY, being that I know you're out here kind of developing as a major IP projo. You know, these are things that you're going to take to your next level in the unit. And I'm glad I didn't have to take that coin back. So actually that coin was from the time you entered the unit and we were flying in combat as a LT. So that was a well-deserved coin and you can keep it. How's that?
Thank you.
Any final words, guys? I was highly, you know, when I can be here buried at my desk and hear and sense what we're doing is different, that just shows that it was. And every time I talked to someone, I found out how different the standard TDY was. So props to everybody that made it happen. Props to leadership that not only helped design it, but enabled the people to succeed down there. There's things that go on beyond, you know, the senior leadership, and that's one thing that I want to make sure people enable the individuals in our unit to do things and get things done, because you don't have to ask. You know, if it's safe, smart, and is mission based, it's probably good to go. Guys, I really appreciate it. Please make sure your team knows that, because this is not just normal. So, all right, I think that will wrap it up for Hogcast number 2 from Rio. So, all right, guys, thanks.